Ekman slipped a tape from the O.J. Simpson trial into the VCR. It showed Cato Kalin, Simpson's shaggy-haired houseguest, being questioned by Marcia Clark, the lead prosecutor in the case. Kalin sits in the witness box with a vacant look on his face. Clark asks a hostile question. Kalin leans forward and answers her softly. "Did you see that?" Ekman asked me. "I saw nothing. Just Cato being Cato, harmless and passive." Ekman stopped the tape, rewound it, and played it back in slow motion. On the screen, Kalin moved forward to answer the question, and in that fraction of a second, his face was utterly transformed. His nose wrinkled as he flexed his levator labii superioris aliqui nasi. His teeth were bared, his brows lowered. "It was almost totally AU9, Ekman said. "It's disgust, with anger there as well, and the clue to that is that when your eyebrows go down, typically your eyes are not as open as they are here. The raised upper eyelid is a component of anger, not disgust. It's very quick." Ekman stopped the tape and played it again, peering at the screen. "You know, he looks like a snarling dog." Ekman showed another clip, this one from a press conference given by Harold Kim Philby in 1955. Philby had not yet been revealed as a Soviet spy, but two of his colleagues, Donald McLean and Guy Burgess, had just defected to the Soviet Union. Philby is wearing a dark suit and a white shirt. His hair is straight and parted on the left. His face has the hauteur of privilege. "Mr. Philby," a reporter asks, "Mr. McMillan, the foreign secretary, said there was no evidence that you were the so-called third man who allegedly tipped off Burgess and McLean. Are you satisfied with that clearance that he gave you?" Philby answers confidently, in the plummy tones of the English upper class, "Yes, I am." "Well, if there was a third man, were you in fact the third man?" "No," Philby says, just as forcefully, "I was not." Ekman rewound the tape and replayed it in slow motion. "Look at this," he said, pointing to the screen. Twice, after being asked serious questions about whether he's committed treason, he's going to smirk. He looks like the cat who ate the canary. The expression came and went in no more than a few milliseconds. But at quarter speed, it was painted on his face, the lips pressed together in a look of pure smugness. "He's enjoying himself, isn't he?" Ekman went on. "I call this duping delight, the thrill you get from fooling other people." Ekman started up the VCR again. "There's another thing he does," he said. On the screen, Philby is answering another question. "In the second place, the Burgess-McLean affair has raised issues of great," he pauses, "delicacy." Ekman went back to the pause and froze the tape. "Here it is," he said, "a very subtle micro-expression of distress or unhappiness. It's only in the eyebrows, in fact, just in one eyebrow." Sure enough, Philby's right inner eyebrow was raised in an unmistakable AU1. "It's very brief," Ekman said. "He's not doing it voluntarily, and it totally contradicts all his confidence and assertiveness. It comes when he's talking about Burgess and McLean, whom he had tipped off. It's a hot spot that suggests you shouldn't trust what you hear." What Ekman is describing, in a very real sense, is the physiological basis of how we thin slice other people. We can all mind read effortlessly and automatically because the clues we need to make sense of someone or some social situation are right there on the faces of those in front of us. We may not be able to read faces as brilliantly as someone like Paul Ekman or Sylvan Tompkins can, or pick up moments as subtle as Cato Kalin's transformation into a snarling dog. But there is enough accessible information on a face to make everyday mind reading possible. When someone tells us, "I love you," we look immediately and directly at him or her Because by looking at the face, we can know, or at least we can know a great deal more, about whether the sentiment is genuine. Do we see tenderness and pleasure? Or do we catch a fleeting micro-expression of distress and unhappiness flickering across his or her face? A baby looks into your eyes when you cup your hands over hers because she knows she can find an explanation in your face. Are you contracting action units 6 and 12, the orbicularis oculi, pars orbitalis, in combination with the zygomatic major, in a sign of happiness? Or are you contracting action units 1, 2, 4, 5, and 20, the frontalis pars medialis, the frontalis pars lateralis, the depressor supercili, the levator palpebri superioris, and the risorius, in what even a child intuitively understands as the clear signal of fear? We make these kinds of complicated, lightning-fast calculations very well. We make them every day, and we make them without thinking. And this is the puzzle of the Amadou Diallo case. Because in the early hours of February 4, 1999, Sean Carroll and his fellow officers, for some reason, could not do this at all. Diallo was innocent, curious, and terrified, and every one of those emotions must have been written all over his face, yet they saw none of it. Why?